Welcome to Whiskey Cask, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 176 for December 7th, 2008. Coming up in a few minutes.
When you nose it, it's just like a Speyside whiskey. Fruity, floral, beautifully balanced nose. But the dryness as you come through certainly carries a lot of this sort of maritime character. And bear in mind, we were maturing all our stock on the warehouses overlooking Scapa Bay itself.
That's Neil McDonald of Chivas Brothers. And for the first time since Pernod Ricard acquired the distillery in 2005, there's a new release of Scapa available. I'll have the details later, but first, let's look at the news. Heaven Hill has debuted the 1999 edition of its Evan Williams Single Barrel Bourbon. Members of the Bardstown Bourbon Society are traditionally the first ones to get to taste the annual release. It's the 14th release in the Single Barrel series, and it won't be in stores until after the first of the year. But the sample I received has plenty of spice to it, along with a great finish. You'll find a link to the Evan Williams website for more details at the Whiskey Cast website. Old Pulteney is getting ready to release a limited edition 30-year-old single malt in early 2009. In the meantime, distillery manager Malcolm Waring is busy with a renovation project.
We're doing a lot of changes just now, certainly structurally, but we're doing a wee bit of internal work. We're going to renew a lot of the internals on the stillhouse, some of the old pipe work, and that's coming out, and put some new stuff in there, but keep it all very traditional in the way it is. Haven't plans to change any of the actual workings of it, just kind of bring the part of the plant into the 21st century. So.
Should be interesting.
Very interesting. It's going through good times just now. Some really good times.
What's it like to take a distillery that's working and then try to have to update it to current standards?
It's very interesting because the layout of the distillery was 1826, so you've got to kind of work within the confines of how somebody planned it in 1826. So you've still got to try and fit modern stuff into an old building, which is it's quite interesting. Very interesting.
How hard is it to actually pull that off? It takes a lot of engineering to make it work, doesn't it?
It takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of thought. But we have time, and we've got a lot of thought. So, looking forward to doing it.
What's the hardest part of the project?
It's maintaining things as they were, really, is what it is. Keeping the traditional aspects and the way we work is quite tricky. Quite tricky.
And maintaining the character of the spirit at the same time.
That's an underlying fact, is we don't want to change anything with that. We want to keep that Pulteney as it is. Don't want to change anything.
I'll have more details on the 30-year-old from Old Pulteney as they're available. Earlier this year, we heard about the 1964 White Bowmore in episode 156. Only 732 bottles of the bourbon cask-aged twin to the Black Bowmore were released worldwide, and Bowmore is now giving you a chance to win one. There's an online competition at the Bowmore website that runs through the end of March 2009, and I've posted a link to the entry forms at the WhiskeyCast website. Bowmore is also getting ready to release a limited edition 13-year-old cask strength single malt. The Maltman's selection was picked by the maltman at the distillery and was aged in sherry casks. It'll be available exclusively through the Bowmore website and at the distillery for £120 a bottle. It's the first in an annual series of releases for the distillery. Of course, the big event of the past week was the 75th anniversary of the end of Prohibition in the United States. There were a number of events around the country to mark the anniversary. I sat down for a few minutes with mixologist and cocktail historian David Wondrich to look back at the Roaring Twenties.
Before Prohibition, cocktails were made by highly trained professionals at expensive bars. The cheap bars in America, they might serve an occasional old-fashioned or something, but they mostly did shots and beers, just as they do now. But the cocktail bars, the cocktail makers were specialists, and it took an apprenticeship and time to learn how to do it. And by 1915 or so, in the few states that were still drinking, the best bars had this 100-year tradition behind them of making great drinks. And the bartenders, brought ingredients in from all over the world and made them up in complicated ways and garnished them beautifully and served them in chilled glassware and all that stuff. That became illegal. Some of them kept on during Prohibition as speakeasies, getting whatever ingredients they could or what they had left. Many of the best went abroad and suddenly set up shop in, Mexico City or Havana or Paris, London, Shanghai, you know, all over the world. There was an exodus of top American bartenders. And those that were left had to be willing to work in a criminalized situation, which meant they were generally younger men, not the kind of older established guys. Those guys went into other work or retired or scuffled along at country clubs and private clubs, et cetera. So they had to be, you know, they were younger men, and you had to deal with mobsters to get your booze, so you had to be okay with that. And it was a different kind of person who worked behind the bar, and they didn't have that knowledge. They made the drinks as well as they could, but they simplified everything, and they left out ingredients, and some of the old drinks got mushed together, so to speak. So a bourbon toddy met the old fashioned, and you came out with the old fashioned with all the fruit in it. And those had been separate drinks before then, and so there was a lot of stuff like that going on.
So it really sort of killed an entire culture, really, the entire cocktail culture in the U.S. until really just a few years ago, right?
Yeah, well, it killed it as an art. You know, people kept the habit of drinking cocktails, but after Prohibition, they drank a lot of cocktails, but there were many fewer in circulation, and they were stronger and less sort of refined. And then that, even by the 60s, even that kind of died out. And yeah, only until recently have we found it again as an art. And, you know, there might be some excesses with that right now. But on the other hand, it's great to see people taking it seriously and practicing a craft.
What's your favorite cocktail from back then that survived?
There's really only one famous popular drink that's still made today and considered a classic that comes out of American Prohibition. Well, actually, there are two. There's the Sidecar, which was a French drink. And that was hugely popular here. That's a Prohibition-era drink. But the only drink that came out of American Prohibition, as far as I've been able to determine, is this thing called the French 75. And it was so named because during World War I, America borrowed an artillery piece from the French, the 75-millimeter gun, which we called the French 75. And this thing was a mixture of bootleg liquor and champagne. The champagne was probably bootleg as well, obviously. And it hit like an artillery piece. They still make that today. It's a little more refined. Now you use real champagne and gin or cognac or both. And it's a delightful drink when made properly. And however made, it definitely leaves you the next morning feeling like you've been under bombardment.
Now, you mentioned that the bartenders at that time did what they could with what they could get their hands on. One of those ingredients was bathtub gin, of course, right?
It was. Bathtub gin, they made it in the bathtub. You would take grain alcohol, which could be made in an industrial facility and then stripped of the poisons they added so people wouldn't drink it, and sometimes it wasn't completely stripped. Or it could be made in the basement around the corner in Brooklyn from potato peels and water and leftovers. You never knew. There was no quality control. And so you'd take that and you'd pour some gallons of it into the bathtub, and then you'd mix it with water about equal parts, pour in some juniper essence or juniper oil or syrup that you could get from Sears. Suddenly everybody needed juniper for some reason. Nobody knew why. You could bottle that up and drink it, more or less. You know, gin was easy to make. Whiskey, not so easy, because that takes aging. So people drank a lot of gin, and that really brought gin from being only one of the popular cocktail liquors to the most popular. And then from that, you know, things kind of morphed into vodka.
How did they fake whiskey back in those days?
Well, they would take real whiskey, as much as they could afford using, and mix it with grain alcohol and water, and then add caramel coloring, and maybe if they were faking scotch, a dash of creosote. Or if they didn't have real whiskey, they would use more creosote and more caramel and maybe some prune juice and some Tabasco pepper, and, you know, or you could also buy bourbon essence, whatever the hell that was, stuff like that. So it was a bad time, you know. It was a nation of people dealing with drug dealers, basically.
And we didn't learn our lesson, did we?
Well, we did and we didn't. We haven't had Prohibition again completely, but, you know, that's that there's a lesson still to be learned on this. People are still making noises about it, and there's still crazy liquor laws that just make things more complicated. And, you know, then we're not even going to get into the whole marijuana thing. And it's legalized morality is always a problem. Let's just say that.
David is the author of several books on cocktails and cocktail history. His books are available through the WhiskeyCast store at the website. The legacy of Prohibition continues 75 years later in some states around the country, as Ben Jenkins of the Distilled Spirits Council of the U.S. explains.
December 5th, 1933 was not the true end of Prohibition. 75 years later, states across the country still suffer from Prohibition-era beliefs and attitudes.
How so? Because I know that the 21st Amendment basically gave all the states the individual power to regulate liquor any way they saw fit for the most part, and a few of them still do excessively in some opinions to this day, right?
Absolutely. I'll give you a few examples. 15 states across the country still ban Sunday spirit sales. 3 states, Georgia, Indiana, and Connecticut, actually ban beer, wine, and spirits off-premise at package stores on Sundays. Another good example is 7 states ban all forms of spirits tastings, even though you have your wine tastings, your beer tastings, but you can't have spirits tastings even 75 years after Prohibition repeal. Also, and this is my favorite, the silliest rule, I think, 7 states still enforce some sort of ban on Election Day sales. So while the polls are open on Election Day, just this past November 4th, voters couldn't go to, or people that were out and about at a restaurant couldn't even have a cocktail in South Carolina, Kentucky, and Indiana.
That particular rule dates back to the old machine politics days in Chicago when you'd get a beer for your vote or something like that in the old Capone days, right?
That's right. It actually goes back probably further than that. I think George Washington was said to have, when he was elected to his first term in office, he took voters out for a drink afterwards to award them. It is a relic of the Prohibition era, and it just doesn't make any sense today.
Prohibition killed off many of Kentucky's small distilleries, but there were a few allowed to supply bourbon for medicinal purposes. Brown-Forman's Old Forester bourbon has a unique place in the history of Prohibition, and as I've mentioned in past episodes, is now releasing a limited edition bottling to celebrate the 75th anniversary of repeal. Chris Morris is the master distiller at Old Forester.
Old Forester has quite a history dating back to 1870. Its reputation as beginning as a medicinal whiskey really helped carry us through Prohibition, allowing us to get a permit, P3, to operate as a medicinal spirits bottler, and then eventually as a distiller once again during Prohibition, and it still stands today. It's the only bourbon that existed before, during, and after Prohibition under same ownership.
Now, I have to ask, because I know that at one point in 1929, the government set up its own distillery in Louisville to basically provide for those companies that had medicinal whiskey licenses. What happened to that distillery?
Well, that distillery is now a big parking lot across from the Dewdrop Inn down on Story Avenue. One distillery is open in Louisville, and one distillery is open in Frankfort, and 3 distilleries in Louisville and 3 distilleries in the countryside around Frankfort use those 2 distilleries. And we were given 100 days a year to distill. And so we had 1/3 of the year. And the other 65 days, who knows what happened there. But Owsley Brown the first had Manuel Ice, my predecessor, several generations ago as master distiller. Get the old strain of yeast, get the recipe, and we walked into that distillery and for 100 days produced Old Forester. And that was it.
And this was because the existing stocks had run out basically 9 years into Prohibition.
Yes, the government, of course, through the Concentration Warehouse Act, was keeping detailed records of what was left in warehouse, and they saw that within 3-4 years, this existing inventory was going to run out. So they approved for the distillation, and there was going to be distillation every year. In fact, it wasn't enacted, so at the very end of Prohibition in 1933, when Owsley Brown reopened our Old Forester distillery, he was able to start distilling Old Forester before Prohibition was ended, based on his quotas that hadn't been fulfilled previously. So he was making Old Forester before anyone else was making bourbon.
And that's what really set Old Forester apart from everybody else in the business to this day, right?
Yes, we were able to recover earlier because Owsley Brown and Brown-Forman would not sell Old Forester until it was fully matured. So even after Prohibition was over, he waited till mature stocks. There was no one-year, two-year Old Foresters, as some companies said. He waited till 4 years before he started releasing Old Forester.
Now let's get to present day, 75 years later. You're releasing the Old Forester Repeal Edition right now. What makes this different from the regular Old Foresters that we've come to know?
Old Forester 86 proof and Old Forester Signature, the 100 proof, are batchings of barrels from different years. So a bottle of Old Forester 86 proof, based on flavor, will have barrels 4, 5, 6 years of age, and the Signature will have barrels 6, 7, 8, 9 years of age. This bottling of Old Forester as Repeal was somewhat indicative of, or reflects Prohibition, because we took bourbon from 1 year, and this happened to be a 10-year batch of bourbon, because they didn't have the luxury of building for flavor. They were bottling out of necessity. So we tried to replicate that practice. So we have a special bottling of 1 year's flavor profile, a 10-year-old Old Forester. So it's atypical of birthday bourbon, of Signature, and of Old Forester 86 proof. It's a unique bottling.
And it's only going to be available for a little while, right?
Yes, we have 1,000 cases, and when it's gone, it's gone.
Now, I've had the chance to try this tonight, and it's really smooth. It's got a little bit of that nice caramel taste, a nice vanilla taste that we've come to know from Old Forester. Why not produce more of this?
Well, we are focusing on our core brands, the 86 Signature, and, of course, the very special limited release annually of the birthday bourbon. So to add another version right now just isn't in the plans. Well, you never know what will happen in the future, but right now that's not in the plans.
And the birthday bourbon we should talk about is sort of the belated birthday bourbon this year. It's in terms of it coming out late this year, right?
Yes, it is the belated birthday bourbon. The cards in the mail. It's going to arrive later on this year. And that boils down to the whiskey was ready. The whiskey is actually in stainless steel tanks right now because we emptied the barrels according to schedule back in the summer. But our glass became an issue. And we received a shipment of glass. It was inferior, and we had to reorder glass, and it's just now arrived. So it's going to be a belated release, but the bourbon will be just perfect.
Earlier, David Wondrich told us about a couple of Prohibition-era cocktails. At the Distilled Spirits Council's repeal party Friday night in New York, Jonathan Pogash was mixing another one, the Mary Pickford.
Mary Pickford was a very well-known star of stage and screen in the 1920s, and it consists of light rum, some unsweetened pineapple juice, homemade grenadine that I make at home, and maraschino liqueur, served in a teacup, of course.
What are some of the other recipes that disappeared?
There was a Ward 8, which is definitely one of my favorites. That was actually a cocktail that was made during the late 19th century and very popular during Prohibition, and it's a bourbon-based cocktail with some fresh lemon juice as well as grenadine and just a really nice, fresh, delicious cocktail. And, of course, making your own cherries and soaking them in bourbon is also a huge thing. And that's definitely something that I do, and it's very, very easy to do as well.
Jonathan also maintains the Cocktail Guru website, and I've posted a link at the WhiskeyCast website. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. First off, I'd like to thank the folks at Laphroaig and Beam Global. This episode marks a year since Laphroaig started sponsoring the calendar of events, and I'm pleased to announce that Laphroaig has renewed its sponsorship through 2009. Now a correction. Back in episode 174 a couple of weeks ago, I listed the dates for Whiskey Live London in early March. I was working off an old schedule. The correct dates for Whiskey Live London are now February 27th and 28th. The Victoria Whiskey Festival is January 23rd through the 25th in Victoria, British Columbia. And the Linköpings Whiskey Expo is February 5th through the 7th in Linköpings, Sweden. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Lefroy Quarter Cask.
Hi there, my name's John Campbell, distillery manager at Lefroy Distillery. Become a friend of Lefroy. Claim your own square foot of Islay at lefroy.com.
The Scapa Distillery on the island of Orkney has lived in the shadows of its larger neighbor, Highland Park, for years. It was mothballed between 1994 and 2004. Pernod Ricard acquired Scapa the next year as part of its takeover of Allied Domecq, and it's now part of the Chivas Brothers stable of malts. Since then, the only distillery bottling of Scapa on the market has been the 14-year-old that came out under the previous ownership. But it turns out there's been a lot going on behind the scenes, and that's now coming to light with the first release of Scapa under the Chivas Brothers management, a 16-year-old single malt. I sat down Friday in New York with Chivas Brothers Director of Malts, Neil McDonald, to get the details.
Well, it was a decision taken when we acquired the distillery back in 2005. We had the chance to really take a long-term view on what we wanted to do with Scapa. The distillery was actually reopened in October 2005, and talking to, you know, the inventory team, they said, look, let's take a chance to look at our stock, because the distillery's been open and closed so many times in the recent years, there's not a very equal stock profile. So it's much better to say, how do we go about getting the right style and character for the whiskey that's going to take us over the next sort of 5 to 10 years, and then sort of build this new reference to take us over that time. Hence the decision was made, let's take the age statement up to 16, which is in fact the youngest age of whiskey in there. And actually, we've done a lot of work on the wood policy as well, just to ensure that the style is going to be, you know, consistent going forward.
And this has all been done behind the scenes, because we really haven't heard much from Scapa since Chivas Brothers took it over.
We've been very, very quiet. You're absolutely right. I mean, it's one of these things that it's a lower profile, if you like, an unsung hero within our portfolio, a much smaller brand, but one that's worth taking the time to get right, because, you know, it's a boutique distillery. It's very, very precious. A lot of people fall in love with the place when they actually visit it there. So it was great. Behind the scenes, we were able to go away quietly doing our work with the team, getting the stock right, and now 3 years later, it's great to actually have a chance to release it.
I remember earlier this year there was actually some speculation that you guys were in the process of maybe selling Scapa at the same time Glendronach was up for sale. And this is a complete surprise to see this new malt come out at this time now.
Yes, there was a lot of speculation on various distillery sales sort of earlier in the year. I don't think it was a surprise when we saw Glendronach go again, though that was a beautiful distillery. You should remember as well, though, that Scapa was one of the original Magnificent Seven distilleries behind the Ballantine's brand, and it's always had, you know, associations with Ballantine's, and still an important part of reflecting the Four Corners of Scotland proposition for Ballantine's. Although, you know, most of the whisky actually is going into single malt rather than blending production, because the distillery capacity is so small.
And on that, are you doing anything to increase the capacity to make this more available in the future?
We've got three people working there full-time, so we're kind of limited in terms of what they do, and they actually work a very interesting rotation where, you know, they all work together Thursday and Friday in the warehouse, filling the casks, getting them into the warehouse themselves, and then they do various shifts during the work actually operating the distillery. We've only got two pot stills, so we're certainly not planning to increase the capacity of the distillery, but hopefully we'll certainly try and make sure that we get as much output as we can.
What's the difference in the taste profile between this 16-year-old and some of the previous Scapa releases that we've seen?
Well, Scapa is known. If you talk to most people about Scapa, the first thing they'll say is, look, it's this wonderful, lighter island style of whiskey, and it's famed for its heather honey kind of notes that come through. It also has a very, very distinctive dryness in the finish. You know, to start with, when you nose it, it's just like a Speyside whiskey, fruity, floral, beautifully balanced nose. But the dryness as you come through certainly carries a lot of this sort of maritime character. And bear in mind, you know, we were maturing all our stock on the warehouses overlooking Scapa Bay itself. So we wanted to retain those core elements of the character themselves, but by introducing our wood policy, where we've either refilled or revatted all the casks into first-fill bourbon casks, or filling new into first-fill bourbon casks, we've introduced certainly stronger oak notes, and you get a lot more of that sort of the creme caramel, vanilla style that you would expect from first-fill bourbon casks. So you know, the nose up front now and the palate is incredibly luscious. That fruity flavor has sort of almost been accentuated, amplified. And it really is just a fantastically delicious whiskey to save in there.
Let's go back into the wood policy a bit more. You say you took some of the old casks and recasked them essentially in new barrels. Am I right on that?
Absolutely right, yes. There was all sorts of stuff in there. You know, I even believe we had some Canadian Club barrels being used within there. We said, look, let's, you know, the one thing we want to get right is our wood policy, especially for a small whiskey like this. So we worked a lot with Sandy Hislop, who's got a long association with Scapa back through his days at Allied Distillers. And he said, no, this is what I would like to do to make Scapa come out well as a whiskey. So again, we took the time, got the casks right, and worked on that.
Can we expect any other releases coming out, or is this it for now?
I think we'll see how this goes. As I said, with the distillery being sort of open and closed over the years, we're rather limited in terms of, you know, stocks that we have. But certainly we see this now as a permanent reference in the range. But, you know, if consumers around the world really take to this, and if they, you know, ask us for more references, obviously that's something that we'll have to look at.
And this is actually going to be available worldwide instead of just in select markets, right?
We are going to be quite selective, but I think the main markets where malt whiskey is sold around the world, so the likes of the US, you know, duty-free, UK, France, etc., definitely Scapa will be available. As you go into the sort of less well-established malt markets like South America or whatever, you'll find it harder to find there.
And I think, if I remember right, I saw the guys at La Maison de Whiskey are bragging about having the exclusive first on this. Is that the case?
Yes, Pernod, who are our distributors in France, have been incredibly enthusiastic about Scapa. And they have a very strong relationship with Thierry Benita and his team there. So, they're fantastic. They have a great network, fantastic for getting into the right hotels and restaurants. So they're going to really play a great role in France for making this much more available and accessible to knowledgeable consumers out there.
But we'll get into the U.S. and other markets after the first of the year?
Yes, we're just about to actually catch up with our U.S. colleagues to talk through the Scapa launch plan. So working on that now.
What else are you guys working on? Because I know it's not just Scapa, it's the Glenlivet and all the other distilleries within the portfolio. What else are you guys working on that we can expect to see?
Well, it's a good question. We have some fantastic brands now. We've got the Glenlivet, and certainly, you know, that's our major spearhead brand, a really dynamic brand throughout the world, and we're certainly looking at more initiatives for Glenlivet coming up, you know, in the next sort of 12 to 24 months. Abelard is another sort of slightly unsung hero within our portfolio. I've worked on the brand for almost 15 years now, and in fact, you know, it's something that's not forgotten, and indeed there is more work going on as well. So watch this space, and again, hopefully in the next sort of 18 to 24 months, you'll see more work coming out there as well.
When do we get the next batch of Abuna?
Well, it's going through all the time at the moment. It's about, with Abuna, it's about making sure that, you know, the sherry class quality is absolutely spot on, because this is such a loved reference. Everyone I talk to, you know, it's when they've tried Abuna, it's almost like it's changed their life. It was the whiskey that, you know, defined single malt whiskey for them. In fact, I think we're on to about batch 26 now. We've got some other things coming up in Abuna that we'll tell you about early in the new year, actually. A special tasting that we're planning to do, where we're actually going to try all the batches ever released side by side, which will be quite an event for us, I have to say.
That special Abuna tasting will be part of the Spirit of Speyside Whiskey Festival in May. Back to the Scapa for a moment. I had the chance to taste the new 16-year-old. I'm not scoring it yet because of the issues with my taste buds that I discussed last week during the Malt Maniacs Awards story, but my initial impressions are that it has a nice, spicy nose from those first-fill bourbon barrels, which also give it a touch of cinnamon and black pepper on the taste. There's a nice, sweet touch on the finish as well. Again, it's available exclusively in Europe through La Maison de Whiskey for the time being, but will be in the U.S. and other markets during the first quarter of 2009. That's all for this episode of WhiskeyCast. My email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com, and I'd love to hear from you. You'll find links, the calendar of events, my whiskey ratings, the WhiskeyCast store, and a complete archive of past episodes at the WhiskeyCast website. The address is www.whiskeycast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of MG Media, copyright 2008, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.